Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Today, contractors will be out in force again in tornado-hit Papatoetoe, removing debris including roofing iron, timber and toppled trees and restoring power to a final few houses. Auckland Emergency Management say at least 32 people stayed in emergency accommodation in motels overnight. Our reporter Katie Todd has been visiting homeowners facing a huge clean-up.
The roof is ripped to pieces and the windows are shattered at Roy Rogers' family home on Balance Avenue. He's been sleeping in the mess for the past two nights, fearing if he left for emergency accommodation, it would be looted. He's still struggling to comprehend how quickly the havoc played out on Saturday morning at about 8:30.
The windows were shaking. Went to check the front door and the front door just flew open. Like that red door there, and like it nearly came off the hinges. So like I ran to my friends, got them to get under the table. I thought it was an earthquake, and so we got under, and then like within the span of 30 seconds it was already gone. Opened the door and you just saw the devastation.
That devastation is still very evident. Almost every house on the street has a brightly coloured tarpaulin patching the roof and a mound of twisted metal, roof tiles, branches and guttering on the berm. There's shattered windows, toppled chimneys, power lines strewn across the footpath, and cars squashed flat. The repair work ahead of Roy Rogers is no small task.
It's more than we thought. A lot more long term. We can clean up all this now, but like there's holes in the roof. And with the rain, because it's winter, it's just going to carry on building up with droplets inside. So we're going to have to fix that up. We've got a massive freezer in the back, so a lot of that's going to go to waste if we don't get it out and kind of donate it as soon as possible.
On nearby Freyberg Avenue, the tornado threw chunks of Julie Wharton's carport into her son's bedroom. He escaped being hit by flying bits of wood by lying flat on the floor. Julie Wharton considers her household lucky in terms of the cleanup.
Down the road, one of the ladies, you can see right into her lounge. You know, got so much damage here. Pretty lucky that we got away with just losing a few bits of wood here and there.
Contractors use cherry pickers to rebuild power lines and they hope to switch the electricity back on in the next day or so. Auckland Council building inspectors have assessed about 240 houses so far, including 62 that are uninhabitable. Neighbours help each other sweep up their yards and board up broken windows. Contractors truck out debris and mulch tree branches. Resident Warwick Wright has been removing bits of timber from his roof that came from a house several doors down.
I got 4x2, about a metre long, sharp as a spear, and it gone dunk. It's actually just garage and back, and there's one in that roof too, the same thing. So that's how bad the stuff was flying around.
He's also been helping his neighbour Rosetta Fale take away ragged bits of wood from her house.
The cool thing about this community is everyone just helped everywhere, like whether you stayed on the street or not. So everyone's just helping. Our neighbours are helping us with our fence right now, so I'm grateful for that.
Also helping out is a contingent of volunteers in high-vis jackets. Darjeet Singh is part of the Supreme Sikh Society, which has brought 1,000 food parcels from their centre in Takanini to the dozen most damaged streets.
We are about 50 volunteers now covering all these streets to provide them fresh milk, bread and hot foods. So each house will be knocking doors and helping them.
Auckland Emergency Management says its teams will keep helping with the clean-up today, along with 15 Red Cross volunteers. People who need help with accommodation, insurance or financial assistance can visit the Civil Defence Welfare Hub at Alan Brewster Leisure Centre from 9 o'clock this morning.
Well, listening to that was the Auckland Mayor Phil Goff, who joins us now. Morena.
Morena, Colin.
The damage, 62 houses. Do you expect that number to increase or is that going to be it?
Well, the optimistic view of the building inspectors that were out there in force, I think about 43 of them yesterday, was maybe that number could come down a little. I went through the area both days myself and, there are some places that are pretty much totaled there. That just won't be habitable. Some that may not even be able to be rebuilt. But we're hoping with, particularly with the huge progress, even from going there on Saturday to coming back on Sunday and seeing the way in which the cleanup was happening and work was occurring. But we would think that it'd be some weeks and for some houses, I think some months before things would be back to normal.
Are you aware of any people and families that have nowhere to go? Is there any help that can be offered for those that maybe are in trouble there?
Yeah, we're offering emergency housing, and last night we had about 32 people, eight families in emergency housing. But talking to folk out on the streets, most of them, you know, oh no, we're staying with mum or dad, we're staying with our kids, or, you know, family really came to the party. A lot of people around yesterday, a lot of them family and friends just come to help with the cleanup. But some people were feeling a little insecure, you know, about their houses, that they had no security, the windows were smashed, etc. But we have had, and I spoke to the police, they were doing regular foot patrols on Saturday night, and I think they will have kept that up. We have got security on the ground there, but we tell people, look, if you can't stay in your home, just take your valuables with you and make sure that, you know, if you have got a secure room in the house that you can put stuff in there and keep it safe. But so far, so good. I haven't heard any reports of antisocial behaviour, but you can never rule that out.
Let's hope not. But are you aware, are there any people perhaps who are staying put when maybe it's not such a good idea?
Some people were suggesting, look, we'll stay in the house. It's a little bit like camping. Fortunately, on the habitable houses, the electricity, I think, has pretty much been restored. There might be a few houses still not restored, but I counted about 30 Vector linesmen out there working through the rain yesterday. Hats off to them too. They did a fantastic job. And, the power poles I saw on the Saturday, the wooden ones snapped off like matchsticks. The metalled ones and the concrete ones, the equally snapped tangle of lines, corrugated iron hanging from the lines, even trampolines. It did look like a war zone on Saturday, but I think, you know, weather permitting, we'll make some further progress today and start to get things back, to close to where it was.
What sort of an impact is this going to have for council services and, I guess, the cost of this cleanup for your council?
Yeah, well, look, it will have some costs, but we're not thinking about council costs at this stage. We're, I suppose, mainly thinking about the cost in terms of the life of Janesh Prasad and the wife and two children that he left behind. I mean, you know, that's the real cost.
Indeed it is. And for the Ports of Auckland, you'll be wanting to make sure that family has a lot of wraparound services and plenty of support provided?
Yeah. Janesh worked for a contractor rather than for the ports, but I'm sure the contracting firm and ports will be doing what they can to help. ACC likewise. Yesterday the Minister for Emergency Management and I set up a Merrill Relief Fund, and the government's contributed $100,000. We'll be doing the same, and we'll be looking. There were groups, out in the street that said, look, we'd like to contribute to that. So we'll be setting that up today and giving help. You know, look, a lot of people are fully insured and they'll be fine. It's disruptive for them. It's inconvenient for them. But the cost of their contents in their home will be met. There are other people that didn't have full insurance. There are some people that were renting and they've lost their possessions. So having this relief fund will be a way in which we can help out in cases of real hardship.
Yes, what do we make of tornadoes in Auckland? I guess a lot of people living in Auckland would not have to worry too much about flooding in certain areas. But this is a natural hazard. New Zealand, we know, is a country with plenty of natural hazards. But tornadoes aren't that common. Is there anything that can be done to mitigate or, prepare for these sort of events now?
It's really hard with tornadoes. I was listening to the Met Service and they were saying, look, you can't really anticipate them. What you have to do is to be able to respond quite quickly. And I think we did respond quite quickly. I was up north planting trees with council actually on Saturday morning, hopped in the car. By the time I'd got back, it was about midday. The command centre had been set up, Fire and Emergency New Zealand, the Urban Search and Rescue, St John's Ambulance Council, Auckland Emergency Management. So, I think they have responded quite quickly. you know, with flooding, you know that there's a severe weather event coming, and we do get a bit of flooding in Auckland from time to time, and, you know, our thoughts are also with people on the coast, to the east coast today. But tornadoes, they're not predictable. Generally, when they've happened, we have more than we expect. Somebody said about 10 a year, but generally they're quite small, and the damage is quite minor. But this tornado had the force that, you know, ports were telling me that, you know, it was capable of picking up a 30-ton loaded container and tossing it about. You know, we didn't have warning. People didn't know it was coming. And it's a minor miracle. Frankly, it's a minor miracle that we didn't have more people killed and injured when I saw the amount of dangerous debris that had been thrown around, the damage to the houses. If this had been a street day, and it was a weekday, I should say, and kids were walking to school and people were going out to work, I think the situation could have been much, much worse.
Indeed. Phil Goff, Auckland Mayor, thank you very much for that.
And the cleanup will begin today on the east coast, as well as where heavy rain caused havoc yesterday. Now, at Tokomaru Bay, the school has been almost completely destroyed and families were evacuated in some areas where houses were flooded. Numerous roads were washed away, including a bridge in Waipiro Bay. Let's go to Tai Rawhiti and to RNZ's Mani Dunlop, who's in Tokomaru Bay. Mani, kia ora. Thank you for being with us today. Tell us, whereabouts are you?
Morena, so I'm in Tokomaru Bay and I've just done a drive through Arthur Street, which is the most impacted street here in Tokomaru Bay, and I've really borne the brunt of yesterday's weather. But a huge sigh of relief, I'm sure, for many that the rain expected overnight hasn't caused any further damage, as can be seen. And obviously the rivers have completely receded. I'm just looking at the main river in town here, which has gone down completely, and a walking bridge, which was washed away, part of it was washed away yesterday, as you can see it, which you couldn't see it yesterday. So, yeah, obviously today it is much stiller than it was yesterday, which will help those who are having to clean up and really see the severity of the impact on their homes. Yesterday afternoon, when I was driving through some of the homes which had lost caravans, one home had lost a container ship which had been completely washed away. People were cleaning out their homes, not to the extent, though, that they could, because they're obviously waiting for the insurance assessors and really coming to grips with what they were having to deal with. And, yeah, it's a lot of people's livelihoods really impacted here on the coast. And when you look at the infrastructure as well, driving up further, a lot of the roads have been blocked off, a lot of slips, as well as a bridge in Waipiro Bay, as you mentioned, washed away, which has isolated about five families. That's on the end of McElroy Road. On the other side, or Kupuarua Road, that has been completely blocked off as well. So about 10 families on that side that are completely isolated as well. So the council and contractors will be working hard again, as they were yesterday, but a bit more light today is what work that will be required to get those people their access back so that they can go onto town and get the supplies that they need.
Mm. Now, what's the situation with the school at Tokomaru Bay? It sounds like it's been, well, pretty much obliterated.
Yeah, when I looked at the school yesterday, there was silk everywhere around it, looking through the windows, classrooms, and the administration block had been destroyed, or the ground had been destroyed. So at this stage, the school won't be reopened, which means for a lot of students, disruption again in terms of doing that distance learning. Unfortunately, because of waiting for those insurance assessors, the cleanups of the school can't get underway today. The focus will be on the homes. So again, though, I'm sure that getting into the school, they'll be able to see what is required for that cleanup and what is needed as to whether or not it can be reopened or not, or whether it is a closure indefinitely, which it was looking like that yesterday. But when driving around, you know, the East Coast is very, very resilient. A lot of floods are down these ways. You know, you were talking to some whānau whose houses, everything was out of their house on their front lawn yet they still had a smile on their face, like, oh, you know, it is what it is. We just have to get on and get on with it. And neighbours and whānau just coming together in order to work on that clean-up. And, you know, Cyclone Bowler in 1988 is still fresh of mind. Those river levels were those levels at that time. And so people were going into that mode of, okay, are we preparing? Are we expecting the worst? Luckily, as the day progressed yesterday, those rivers were receding, that rainfall stopped. Overnight, there was a little bit of anxiety about whether or not that same rain would come again, but it hasn't. So a big sigh of relief here on the coast for many, I'm sure.
And I guess for the children who go to Tokomaru Bay, for those tamariki, what's going to happen about schooling?
Well, based on the communications from the principal and the chair, Lillian Ward, they'll go return back to their distance learning, which obviously COVID has really prepared them for that. And just looking at that school, and it's a small school, but it's full of community. Again, that resilience comes back through. And so I think that they have the structures in place in order for the kids to be able to still do their mahi from home.
Ngā mihi, thank you very much. That is RNZ's Mani Dunlop.
Now to the third day of the World Test Championship cricket final between New Zealand and India in Southampton, which ended due to bad light. Kyle Jameson picked up a 5-wicket bag overnight, though, with India skittled out for 217. It is the fifth time in just 8 tests that Jameson has taken a 5-wicket haul. And he says to grab the wicket of the Indian captain, Virat Kohli, was a great way to start the day.
He's obviously a massive part of their lineup, and to get him early certainly set things up nicely for us. I guess it was pleasing in terms of, you know, for myself, being able to try and wobble the ball and try and keep him in check a little bit, and to get that wicket was just a great start for our day. We spoke around, you know, how we wanted to operate this morning and how important today was going to be in the context of the game. So to start that way was pretty pleasing.
Indeed, chasing that 217, New Zealand reached 101 for 2 before being forced off the field, with Tom Latham caught out on 30 and Devon Conway also dismissed just before the close, caught on 54. Kane Williamson and Ross Taylor will resume at the crease tomorrow, weather permitting. On the line is BBC cricket journalist Henry Moran. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning to you, Corin. How are you doing?
Very well. You'd have to say, and it was a pleasing wake-up this morning for me, that this was a day for New Zealand.
It was, no question about it. We wondered. The key was, how would New Zealand bowl on that morning where you've got the conditions where the ball moves around a little bit? Could you get Virat Kohli out early? Everything went to plan. To get India, all out for 217 is a remarkable achievement. The aim now for New Zealand is to bat once and bat big. Make this a 3-innings game. We've lost time because of the weather. We're likely going to lose more time because of the weather. If New Zealand can take a hefty lead into that second India innings, avoid having to bat again, then there's no reason why, with the time we've got left, even if we lose a little bit more, they can't win this game and ensure that they lift that World Test Championship title.
That is not going to be an easy task, though, is it? Even though New Zealand got to nearly 100 without losing a wicket, it's still difficult batting.
It is. It's really difficult. It's as tough a conditions as you could wish for in England. You've got overcast skies. It's quite humid, so the ball's zipping about all over the place. They're using this Duke's cricket ball as well, which is the one that James Anderson and Stuart Broad have had such success with here in England over the years. And it does move a little bit more through the air. And that's what benefited New Zealand's bowlers, who were swinging it far more than India managed to, with New Zealand batting. Carl Jameson, Tim Southee, Trent Bolt all did a really good job with the ball. The challenge is going to be if Jasprit Bumrah, Mohammad Shami, Ishant Sharma tomorrow morning can get that ball moving, it's going to be a real challenge. Kane Williamson and Ross Taylor have faced every condition in the world, but there are certain challenges that even the best batsmen will find pretty, pretty tough. And so I think that morning session is going to be vital. If those two can get through the first hour and New Zealand can get towards where India are, then there's no reason they can't approach the rest of the day thinking this is our opportunity to take that big lead, put all the pressure on India, perhaps get some exhaustion going in the Indian bowling ranks and a bit of demoralisation perhaps as well. And that could be the big chance.
Yes, it's worth noting because India started quite well with their batting too. And it took a day for New Zealand to readjust with line and length. And I wonder too whether the Indians will have the chance now to reassess their bowling strategies.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. And No question about it. The way that New Zealand bowled early on this day was a lot fuller. It gave the ball a lot more opportunity to move. And just a word for Kyle Jameson, the way he set Virat Kohli up, it was sensational seeing bowling, because it's very easy to see a guy who's 6'8" and think his one weapon is he's going to bowl quick and fast and short. But this was really canny, clever bowling. He got the ball moving away from the right-hander and then one to dart back in again, struck Kohli on the pads, and he had to go LBW. It was such good bowling. He fully deserved his 5 wickets. Outstanding work. And actually, if you look at the way that New Zealand bowled today compared to how India bowled today in similar conditions, yes, India could adjust things a little bit, but it's the fact that New Zealand just seemed to be able to cope with the swinging conditions and adapt to it and make the most of it better than India's bowlers can. Perhaps that's because they've had a couple of test matches here to prepare and India haven't. Perhaps it's because the conditions are maybe a little bit more like the home conditions that New Zealand will be used to back at home. But either way, the key has been the way that New Zealand have bowled and made sure that India don't get that big first inning score.
Henry Moran, thank you very much for that. BBC cricket journalist there with a wrap-up of the third day's play. There's going to be 6, potentially.
A warning, this story discusses self-harm and suicide and may not be suitable for all listeners. The Children's Commissioner is calling for an end to the law which allows judges to remand children to police cells after their first appearance in a youth court. In the 12 months to June the 30th last year, more than 110 teenagers were detained alongside adults in police cells for at least 24 hours. During that time, 5 young people self-harmed or attempted to commit suicide in the cells, the youngest just 14 years old. Katie Doyle reports.
Tupua Ehrlich was no stranger to the cells growing up.
They're violent. You know, the police, they do what they can, but you're in there with people who are often high on drugs, super aggressive. And if you could just imagine being locked in a cage and, you know, they're not quiet places. People are banging on the doors, picking up the whole mattresses and slamming them on doors. It's always noisy. There's swearing, there's yelling, there's so much anger in that space.
After a childhood in care, he faced the world as a teenager, feeling dislocated from relatives. He says the state did not invest time into restoring his family relationships. Angry and frustrated, self-harm became a part of his life.
There was one incident where I had to be detained by the police. I totally agree that that was necessary at that time, but I wasn't provided the supports that I needed. I really needed specialist support there rather than being strapped into a chair in a cell.
Police cells, Mr. Ehrlich says, are not healthy places for young people. Figures obtained by RNZ reveal that in the year to June 2020, more than 110 young people were held in a police cell for more than a day. In that same period, 5 young people self-harmed or attempted to commit suicide, the youngest just 14 years old. Assistant Police Commissioner for Iwi and Communities, Krista Watner, says police don't want to put young people in their cells.
I mean, it's sad in the first place that we've got people that age in our custody. I think there's stuff that happens obviously on the street in people's homes and our communities that we end up being called, and for whatever reason is going on in someone's life, we end up with a young person in our custody. It's absolutely not ideal, and I think we'd be the first to say we'd rather not have youth in our custody.
Mr. DeWatner says police are working hard to stop young people entering the system in the first place. As a district court judge, Children's Commissioner Andrew Beecroft presided over the suicide of a teenager in police custody. The person hadn't been deemed a suicide risk.
Humanly speaking, the case would draw tears from stone. I mean, it had an enduring and profound impact on me, and I've never faltered in my view since then that we shouldn't be putting children and young people in police cells.
Judge Beecroft says there are times when a short cell stay may be necessary, such as before a first youth court appearance. But he wants to remove the legal ability for judges to remand youth offenders to the cells after they have appeared in court.
That was only ever put in as a stopgap in 1989 is a court order into a police cell that can be for several days and in the old days sometimes weeks. Now that should not continue. It could be easily repealed and it ought to be repealed, and my plea is that it be repealed urgently.
Phil Dinham from Oranga Tamariki says both the agency and police agree no young person should be held in the cells for a day or more.
Police and us working really hard together daily to make sure that these are minimised. And not only have we over halved the number in the last couple of years, but you have to understand that's with the inclusion of 17-year-olds as well. So that added about 20 or 25% volume of young people going through the youth justice system.
Phil Dinham says the agency also has overnight rapid response teams in areas of high demand like Waikato and Rotorua. He says the specialist youth justice staff can respond at police stations, checking whether the young person is showing signs of trauma, risk or distress. Tupua Ehrlich says it's time to see a wider social change, which seeks to understand why young people can get so upset.
And it's really easy to look at behaviour without understanding its source, because actually the source of it is on us all as society. Our young people are feeling these ways because of things in their environment, and we are their environment.
Well, New Zealand First is set to make a political comeback, but Winston Peters hasn't yet confirmed he'll be sticking around to lead it. After months in hiding, Mr. Peters made a rare public appearance at his first party AGM since the party was turfed out of Parliament at the last election. He used the opportunity to take aim at almost every party in Parliament, the use of te reo Māori and cancel culture. Our political reporter Katie Scotcher was there.
Ready? We are coming back. Again? I want them to hear it downtown Queen Street. We are coming back.
A self-described phoenix rising from the ashes, New Zealand First is back.
So many critics and scribes have tried and continue to write our obituary. But we are here today, as always, steadfast and resolved to put New Zealand first.
Mr. Peters has been MIA since the election, when his party was booted from Parliament, picking up just 2.6% of the party vote. But making his return at the party's AGM in Auckland, he didn't hold back during his 40-minute address.
We do not intend to put the name New Zealand on the endangered species list. They now are whacking tradies and farmers with a fee to make it cheaper for Ngāti Woke to buy an electric car. They say, so why did you not go with National in 2017? Have a look at the mess they're in. The city of sales has become the city of snails. Growing in our country, you know, today is a cancel culture where anyone who asks a legitimate question is belittled as a colonialist, a racist, a bigot, a chauvinist, or worse still, not new, woke age.
About 150 loyal New Zealand First members were at the AGM, where a new party president was elected. Julian Paul will take over from acting president and former MP Derek Ball. Members also analysed last year's crushing election loss, but the former New Zealand First MP Shane Jones wasn't interested in giving any reasons for what caused it.
Look, it's a bit like Steve Hansen. All Blacks had a bad game, flush it down the dunny and move on.
Party faithful are optimistic about the future and New Zealand First's political comeback.
I'm feeling very confident we are going to be back in Parliament like you've never seen before.
We are planning a really good comeback.
And everyone's all fired up and positive and looking forward to the next couple of years and getting us back in into government, because goodness me, over the last 8 months we've certainly seen why New Zealand First need to have a seat at the table.
One question, however, remains unanswered. Will Winston Peters lead the party into the 2023 election?
That's our fervent hope and belief.
Mr. Peters' supporters want the 76-year-old to stick around too.
I think Winston is the man to lead New Zealand First. I think that we all aspire to his attitude and his desire to see New Zealand and the people of New Zealand progress.
I think he's still valuable. Whether he wants to be the leader or not is up to him.
Winston is the leader for us, for all of New Zealand.
But the question couldn't be put to the man himself. Despite promising to speak to reporters after his speech, Mr. Peters vanished moments after stepping off the stage. Watch this space.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.